Breaking down the top NBA draft prospects across the globe, you're listening to the Prospect Podcast with Ethan Piotta and Alex Brown. Welcome back to another episode of the Prospect Podcast. I'm Ethan Piotta, joined by my co-host Alex Brown. We're extremely happy to be back, dropping another episode on four very interesting bigs in the 2021 class. Starting with Isaiah Jackson, JT Thor, Dayron Sharp, and Sandro Mamukelashvili. Alex, how's it going today?
It's going well, man. I'm glad we can get back in the podcast game. I know we've been out for a while, but you know, we're back. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. A lot of exciting things in the basketball world coming up. Talking about the NBA draft is approaching faster than we know it. Summer League just got announced in early August. And starting with our first prospect that we're going to talk about today, Isaiah Jackson, freshman from Kentucky. Obviously a tremendous secondary rim protector in this draft, has some really special tools as far as his verticality and shot blocking. Questions do arise about his frame, his stature, and maybe what kind of impact he can provide on the offensive side of the ball. Alex, what are your initial thoughts on Isaiah Jackson?
Well, yeah, like you said, he is an incredible secondary rim protector. He's probably one of the best we've seen in recent years at the college level as far as being able to make plays as a rotating rim protector. I think he's top tier of this class along with Evan Mobley. The issue I see with him as a rim protector is he's not really a true defensive anchor like your anchor fives you see in the league. Unless the opposing team is playing, you know, small ball with a non-threat in the post or, you know, something along those lines, because he gets bullied by physicality and size in the post because he is only 210 pounds or so, probably a little slighter than that. And he's just definitely at an advantage or a disadvantage rather when he cannot mitigate post players effectively with his length. He's just so much better with space to load. So what he gives you is a guy that's going to be really, really impactful off the ball as a rim protector, event generator, and general disruptor due to those impressive tools that you mentioned. He's going to be a guy that's going to be able to switch and pick and roll, be able to play drop as well, and give you just about anything you want defensively, from a big that can move in space, because he could switch probably 1 through 4 pretty easily, because he has the length to contest and the bounce and the mobility and the activity. He kind of gives you the full package except for a post defender for a big on defense. So if he had more bulk, I would probably value his rim protecting more, because, you know, he'd be able to anchor the defense. But he seems like a secondary guy to me, and I'm curious how that evaluation changes your value placed on him, Ethan.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I'm also not in on him as that defensive anchor. Looking at him with his current stature, like you said, only about 210 pounds, he's going to get bullied by guys who are bigger than him at the five, and that's almost a mismatch in a way. However, I do agree with what you said about his switchability. He's got great lateral movement, also great confidence in his lateral movement when he's guarding smaller guys on the perimeter. I'm perfectly fine with deploying him in those situations. I just wonder, you know, to segue into his offensive side, I don't think it's all bad. I don't think it's a lost cause for Isaiah Jackson. You know, I do have some hope that he'll be able to improve on that end. And again, this kid's only 19, 20 years old. Didn't shoot at all this year from three. We saw some mid-range, very limited attempts from him. He did shoot 75% from the free throw line, though.
It's 70%, if I recall.
70%. So a little bit lower. But what I did like about what I saw at the free throw line was his mechanics were fluid. I didn't really have any major concerns with how he looked. I think you can, you know, deploy him offensively, maybe in the dunker spot as a lob threat, as a vertical spacer, But man, does his value just completely change if he puts on some bulk? I don't know how realistic that is for him, but just talking about, again, him as a rebounder, especially as an offensive rebounder, he's always seemingly in the right spot. His positioning is great. Where things go wrong is when he's encountering bigger fives, bigger interior defenders, and guys like that, that are then altering that positioning, not allowing him to display his verticality, and limiting kind of his space that he can wreak havoc as an offensive rebounder. So I guess my question is, I just still don't know where you deploy him. He's really fit dependent at this point, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I think the bulk part of that is the major part of his fit. Obviously, it's either bulk or shooting. You either become a shooting four wing that can play that, you know, defensive, you know, that secondary defensive anchor that and switch everything, which would be amazing. I mean, if he shoots, he'd be phenomenal value, but I don't think he's going to shoot enough to get there. The more reasonable path yeah. would seem to be bulking. And I think then the goal would be to turn him into a Montrezl Harrell type of guy, a guy that's going to bring that relentless motor that Jackson has shown, and pair that with length, the rim protection, crashing the offensive glass, finishing plays for you, doing all the dirty work inside. And I think that's the more reasonable path. And I'm sure NBA teams and trainers will find if he's receptive to that or not, if that's their goal for him, you know, we'll have to find out. But as far as carving out an impactful role, I think that's the best path for him, because he's going to have to defend fives if he really wants to maximize his value, or he's going to have to shoot. And yeah, if either of those develop, you're going to get a really, really impactful role player. If they don't, you know, you get a monster off ball defensive guy that can, you know, finish plays for you, which there's still value there, just not as much intrigue compared to some of the other guys in this class. But he is one of the biggest if he shoots, if he bulks kind of guys in this draft. So very, very interested in seeing where he ends up, because he's a really fun developmental project that I'm sure, based on how teams seem to be valuing him. Yeah, I think teams really see an avenue to fulfilling one of those two things.
I think, yeah, I mean, the tenacity, the confidence, and the motor that he plays with are all going to bode really well for him in the pre-draft process, and just as well, you know, just looking back at his tape throughout his freshman campaign. Those are all extreme positives, in my opinion, on Isaiah Jackson. So you hope that he then takes seriously going down one of those two avenues of, you know, I think obviously the 10% outcome is that he becomes a shooter. The 90% outcome is that he, it might even be more swayed, you know, the 95 to 5% that he becomes just, you know, bigger in terms of his stature, in terms of bulking. Because, I mean, if he does bulk and he is able to pass against most fives in the NBA, I mean, it makes him extremely interesting. And again, he's still 20 years old. He's got room to grow. So it is going to be super interesting to see kind of just the case of Isaiah Jackson, of where he ends up landing in this upcoming draft, if he does stay in, and kind of where teams, you know, display him in their lineups early on.
Yeah. How would you value his upside compared to somebody like Kai Jones or Jackson Hayes, two guys that also have elite physical tools, pretty elite rim protection potential, at least more so on Hayes and Kai right now, but similar archetypes, similar bodies, maybe Jackson's a little slighter, but anyway, how would you value Isaiah's upside compared to those two guys?
I think Kai is, I mean, I'm definitely higher on the upside of Kai Jones, definitely judging by the fact that I think a shot is in there for Kai Jones. Exactly, I think that's something that he can develop. And he also is sturdier in frame and as a five. He's not as slight as Isaiah Jackson is. Maybe not entirely almost on the level of rim protection that Isaiah Jackson is on too, in my opinion, just with his overall impact of being able to, you know, potentially guard fives right away. So I definitely go with Kai in terms of upside, and mainly though, because I believe in him developing as a shooter more than I do Isaiah, based off what we've seen. And as far as Jackson Hayes goes as well, I guess it is kind of a similar case in a way. I think Jackson, at least dating back to when he was coming out, I was more sold on his touch and, you know, things that he could do as an offensive player over what Isaiah showed in terms of, you know, post moves and, you know, acting as a true play finisher. I think Isaiah is really kind of lob dependent, you know, putbacks, offensive rebounds. I think you can do, I thought you could do more with Jackson when he was coming out as maybe a post player than what I envision Isaiah as going forward.
Yeah. And I wanted to bring that up because Jackson Hayes, obviously still really young, similar size at 6'11", obviously a little more filled out, 220, but you know, average, and he's still a set, he just finished his second year, so by no means draw conclusions, but I mean, he averaged 7.5 points a game, you know, less than a block per game, you know, 4 rebounds in about 16 minutes. And his shot is kind of coming up, you know, starting to show flashes a little bit. You know, he shot the ball a lot better this year. At least he showed some willingness in some of the games. I think he made like, I don't think he shot a lot of threes, but he made a few to make it look convincing. But he's still a guy that hasn't found, you know, a 20 minutes per game role in the league. And he does things that are better. Like you said, that touch, et cetera, and better physical tools than a guy like Jackson. Wow, Jackson and Jackson. I realize that's going to sound confusing now. So I'll say Hayes does some things better than Isaiah does. And he's still struggling to carve out a role that is, you know, super high impact, worthy of lottery. And if he has things that are further along and he's still a project that's going to take over 2 years to really hit his, I mean, obviously it takes longer than 2 years to hit your upside, but that hasn't really provided a ton of value yet. Where is that going to leave guys like Jackson, like Isaiah Jackson?
Right.
Because, yeah, I see the concern there because I think he doesn't give you that extra thing on offense that guys like Hayes do.
And you know, and that's a great point. It's a great comparison too, just kind of similar builds, similar guys coming out that you wonder where they'll be able to be placed and impact the game. Jackson Hayes, again, and we're still, you know,
still very young.
This isn't anything career determination on Jackson Hayes, but
we like Jackson.
I absolutely. But the truth is that, you know, Steven Adams was not good for most of this year. And most of the time, Jackson Hayes still couldn't carve out a role to get on the floor over guys like him and Willie Hernan Gomez on the Pelicans. So, you know, it is interesting, and it kind of just shows you, like, where will Isaiah Jackson be able to play in his first couple of years in the NBA? Where is he going to get a meaningful role, you know, if he doesn't go one of those two avenues? Right. And that's kind of – exactly. And that's why I'm on the – I've been on the side of Isaiah Jackson. I've seen a lot of people kind of declare him surefire first round guy over the last few weeks. I'm still teetering on him between my late first round, early second round, because I'm not entirely sold on the role. I'm sold on his elite skills and tools that he's shown us that we know he has in terms of his secondary rim protection, in terms of his, you know, potential play finishing, lob threat ability. But I can't, you know, cement him as a surefire top 20 or so guy because I don't know what his role is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a good conversation to have about these archetypes in the league. And this does not mean you should take Asbjørn Midtgaard over Isaiah Jackson by any means, but it's just worth considering, okay, what is he not bringing that teams really need, you know, and guys like Jackson Hayes, and can Isaiah Jackson do it better? You know, we'll see. I think he's a little behind offensively, but there are the tools, you know, it's all there. So he'll be a fascinating one to watch develop. And I really hope he hits on his offensive upside as well, because if you get him there, I mean, that's going to be a really fun player that can make an impact in the playoffs and, you know, crush teams on defense. But I really hope he hits that because it'd be really fun. I'm just remain skeptical.
Yeah, skeptical kind of, again, on is he an 82-game player or a 16? Is he a 16-game player? Is he not a 16-game player at all? We kind of had this conversation last year.
Yeah.
Leave it to Alex to be able to name drop Asbjørn Midtgaard on the show. Got to love that.
Jessup's going next.
Right. Moving to our next prospect, though, and this is one of my – I mean, I texted you about him earlier. This is one of my favorite guys in the entire class, if he stays, of course. But JT Thor, freshman from Auburn, 6'10 guy that can do a number of different things at the wing defender spot. And I'm also just extremely high on him as a stretch big moving forward with his basketball career. Alex, you know, there's still a lot of, you know, skepticism between, will JT Thor come out this year? Should he be pre-drafted? Should he get a first round promise from some team? You know, I personally believe guys like him and Ben Mathurin are going to be pretty surefire first round guys, you know, barring anything drastic in next year, 2022. But what are your thoughts on JT Thor and kind of, you know, what he can provide to a team if he does end up getting drafted this year?
Yeah. So regarding the will he come out question, obviously we can speculate on that all we want, but at the end of the day, it's what his camp is gonna, you know, say is best for him, and we don't have insight on into that camp right now. So I get the argument for pre-drafting him, because from an evaluation standpoint, he has all the tools. You know, he looks like a guy you can play at that switchable four, like modern four spot, that can defend pick and rolls, that can defend wings and guards and space, and rotate on as your rim protector as well. Like, we get that. We see the tools that he provides on defense, and we see the really great flashes of his offensive game, especially the potential with his shot, which I would love to see an Ethan Piotta shot mechanic evaluation.
It's coming.
That we
it's
saw coming. From, oh, let's go.
It's coming.
I love that. Just like the Tyrese Maxey one, you know, because I think he has a lot of mechanical, I guess, idiosyncrasies that are not too difficult to correct. I think he has a pretty good feel for the jumper in general. So I think he's a guy that could shoot. I don't know how good of a shooter he's going to be yet. I'm still waiting on the Ethan video for that.
I mean, let's talk about him as a shooter. I mean, this is,
yeah, again, sure.
And this is someone that is, to preface, six, if you're not familiar, which I'm sure our listeners are familiar with JT Thor, is
if you're six, not, you should be.
Right, 6'10" with a 7 foot plus wingspan. I think, you know, he just, to preface again, he has a very pretty shot for someone that is 6'10". In terms of his upper body, his release point, it's almost unblockable in a way. He shoots it very effortlessly as well off the catch. But like you said, there are a few mechanical, you know, weaknesses that if they are corrected, it changes, you know, him shooting 30% on three attempts per game this year to potentially league average or slightly above at the NBA level, maybe at the peak of his NBA career. He's a two motion shooter right now. He brings it up and then back, he brings it down and then back up to shoot. And his base is also just slightly off kilter. And I'll definitely get into that. Definitely volatile. And I'll get into all this on a video that I'm going to be dropping soon on JT Thor. When I see 30% for JT Thor, I like watching his attempts this year. If he gets five more of those to roll in, just with, you know, mechanical differences, he's a 35% three-point shooter at 6'10" as a freshman. So, you know, I'm in on him as a shooter. I think that's something that when you're pre-drafting, if you know, a team is to give him a first round promise, that's got to be the number one thing. Is I'm not even really viewing his jumper as a swing skill at this point. I think he makes the corrections, and it's something that at 6'10" is one of his strengths going into either this year's draft or next year's draft.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the way NBA teams have been developing guys as shooters, I don't see any reason why Thor can't make it there. I mean, he has the prerequisites. I think he just needs to iron out some idiosyncrasies. And once you let's say he does that and becomes a league average 3-point shooter or close to it in either direction. Now you have a guy that can kind of play that modern four wing spot. You know, we call it the modern four. I kind of say four wing. But he's going to be able to defend, you know, your 4-3-2, rotate rim protect, and, you know, generate events with his length. That's, I mean, and of course, you know, shoot the ball. So that's a really impactful position that I really like.
You know, in other terms too, he's playable with another five if he gets to that level. Like, I think if you're drafting him at the end of the first round this year, I don't think the Nuggets still have a pick, but like, and just to preface again, teams like the Nuggets with Jokic, teams like the 76ers with Embiid, I mean, if he develops to that league average, to slightly above average or maybe a little bit below, with some of his tools as a wing defender, it's almost a seamless fit next to one of those guys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you have to play him at the modern four spot. I think playing him at the five, unless it's, again, a small ball situation where you could pass it, I think that's the perfect fit for him. And especially having a five that could pass, you know, get looks for him. Because he's not a guy that's going to really play make for himself or for others. He's going to rely on other guys. But with that defensive value, all he needs to do is shoot. And he could be a very good role player in the NBA. So I'm very much in on the idea of JT Thor. I'm curious how teams are going to value him in the pre-drafting sense. You know, what is he going to bring to us day one? You know, probably defense, a little bit of shooting. I would take him this year if I were an NBA.
I was just going to ask you, if you were GM, Alex, would you pull the trigger on him late? Or I'll just disclose, I have him as, I believe, 19 on my board right now.
He's 30 for me. So he's like, if he's there at the end of the first round, yeah, I'd snag a guy like Thor, but he could probably rise. Again, I want to see how he looks this offseason as well. How is his shot developed? If it's developed, has his body developed? You know, we'll see. But yeah, I love guys that can be disruptive defenders that can shoot. If he gets there, I mean, you have a really switchable guy that can disrupt off the ball. I mean, I'm all in on that. So if I'm a GM, even though I'm kind of iffy on pre-drafting from a strategy standpoint, not from an evaluation standpoint, but definitely from a strategy standpoint, I'd still take Thor just because I think he can add a tool day one in defense.
And there,
a lot of guys can't when you pre-draft them. So
absolutely,
I want to take him in and develop his shooting in-house.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Let the organization be the kind of the motor behind his shot development.
And we'll have to see as well, because I don't have any real intel on Thor. He's not a guy I've worked the intel side for. You know, what kind of guy is he? Is he going to be loyal enough to stick with a team if they pre-draft him by the time his second contract hits? Is he the guy that is going to want a bigger role somewhere else? You know, right. How much are we going to be able to learn from that side will also be really important to how teams value him. But from a pure on-court evaluation standpoint, I totally get the argument for him first round this year, and I agree with it.
And I loved your point about, you know, there's a difference and we'll talk about, I'm sure, pre-drafting a lot, you know, before final declarations are made, because it's a really interesting topic. But it's a great point between, yes, you take him from an evaluation standpoint, but if you are one of those teams from a strategy standpoint with the, you know, one less year before a second contract year arrives, do you pull the trigger then? It's an entire discourse.
Right. It's like a whole nother year of development we could have for our playoff team. Like,
exactly.
If we have him when he's better on a rookie contract, I'd kind of rather have him than theoretically from a strategy standpoint. Even though we know he's going to be good, kind of like Brooke Knight last year. It's like people knew he was going to be good, but if he had the year that he had in college basketball in the NBA, he'd still be a bit behind where, you know, he would be after he comes into the league this year.
But then, if you're a team at the end of the first round, and I'm sure this is exactly what you're saying as well, like if you don't pull the trigger on, again, we'll use Thor as the example here. Maybe he ups his draft stock to mid first round or, you know, late lottery next year, and then it's completely out of your reach based off your situation. So it's it's kind of just random in how it goes. You kind of just have to, again, strategy and evaluation. But it's a great point, again, about Book Knight as well. People knew, teams knew he was going to be good. Didn't pull the trigger on him last year, though, because of kind of that pre-drafting concept.
Right. And I think a lot of the, you know, we'll call him draft Twitter in the media in general, needs to make that different, that, I guess that, draw that line between strategy and evaluation. Because we can all see upside. Like, anyone that can scout the game knows upside. And it's there with guys like Thor. It's a question is, when can we sell this to our GM? Are we comfortable with him not providing X amount of value for the next couple of years and then have him be good for another year and then we have to pay him? You know, so it's an interesting argument to have. But from an evaluation standpoint, 100% understand the value with JT Thor. He's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, super interesting case to kind of watch under this realm. Just one more question on Thor before we move on to Dayron Sharpe. At his medium outcome, what do you project him to be on the defensive side of the ball in the NBA? We kind of talked about this already, but, you know, I just kind of want to expand on it in terms of his role as a wing defender. Because from what I'm, you know, gathering, I personally don't buy him as a five, and I'm thinking that you are the same.
I don't either. Yeah. If I could elaborate. So I know I mentioned earlier, I have him as a modern four, which still kind of classifies as a big. It's kind of that wing big combo position that's really started coming up, like, you know, the Jeremy Grant position. That's what I try to call it. But I think if he hits his median outcome, he has the tools already as far as length, size, and mobility to defend multiple positions. I mean, he flips his hips really quickly, flashes excellent timing. Again, he has the same tools that I just mentioned to be disruptive off the ball on defense. He'll be a threat in passing lanes. He'll, I mean, be a really solid secondary rim protector as his timing improves once he catches up to the NBA speed. So I think he gives you a guy that's above average at the very least in a lot of skills that are really valuable. I think the high outcome is he becomes very, very disruptive. You know, obviously a guy that can go be all over the floor, et cetera, read the game at a high level. But I don't see a way he doesn't at least hit above average differentiated value, you know, stuff that's going to keep him on the floor. I think he hits that, even in his medium outcome.
I completely agree with that assessment. I guess kind of just to make it clear that neither of us are buying him at that five role, especially because, you know, and still super young, but I don't know if his movement will ever be there to, you know, fully switch onto smaller guards and play in certain pick and roll coverages. But then again, I'm comfortable. I think I'm comfortable with him, you know, maybe at his peak guarding 3 for 5 or 3 through 5. If he is able to kind of fill out a little bit, especially his upper body, and kind of become more of a force on the interior. Cause again, as a weak side rim protector or as someone that can play the passing lanes, I mean, he has just extreme potential on the defensive side of the ball. And moving on to another freshman big, that could potentially be coming out this year, is projected to come out to the NBA draft in Dayron Sharpe from North Carolina. Started his high school career playing with Cade Cunningham at Montverde, and ended playing at North Carolina under Roy Williams with 6 other centers on the team. But I did enjoy watching Dayron this year as a freshman. He does a lot of interesting things at his size that you wouldn't necessarily think he could do, I guess, in terms of his kind of his processing speed. And obviously one of his biggest skills, which in my opinion is his vision and him as a high to low post passer, especially in the short role, and the things that he can do with his vision. But there are certainly questions about Dayron, kind of, again, what mold, what role does he fit into at the NBA level, not having outstanding vertical pop and shot blocking ability, averaged under a block per game, although it was in limited minutes in a backup role at North Carolina.
So same minutes as Isaiah Jackson, just so we're clear. He's like one of the less, I think.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. But Alex, what are your kind of thoughts on De'Ron Sharpe? Are you in on him as someone that you'd maybe even take in the first round, or is he more of a second round guy, someone that you're not as sold on?
So I know it's not the most popular opinion, but I'm not as sold on De'Ron because I think he only has one tool right now, and that is his processing speed and playmaking. And you can make an argument for rebounding as well. But if you take away, I mean, first of all, for him to really make a high impact as a passer, you know, possession to possession, he has to have the ball in his hands quite a bit. Theoretically, I mean, if you want to get the most value out of his passing, you have to give him the ball. If he doesn't have that tool or doesn't have access to it, what does he give you? Does he give you an advantage at the play finisher spot? I mean, I'm not all the way there. Does he give you an advantage as a shooter? No. Is he an efficient post player? Not really. And then you also, okay, is he a roller? Not really.
Right.
Instat had 2.5% of his possessions as the pick and roll man. And he had an incredible 42% of his possessions were in the post. And then the second highest was on putbacks. So I see a guy that, while he has that really interesting tool with that processing speed that I love, first of all, I love bigs that process the game really well, love bigs that can pass. I'm worried he doesn't give you anything else yet. And I don't think he's good enough on the interior as a post-up threat to really, I mean, mitigate some of the other concerns. So he's an old style big with one new tool, or one tool that's valued in the new game.
And yeah, that's a great way to put it.
That concerns me. And he also concerns me on defense. I don't think he's the archetype of an anchor big that you would want in a starting lineup, first of all, by any means. But I just don't see a lot of differentiation for him other than the passing and the processing speed. And I'd love to be wrong about that, because anytime you can find a big that processes the game well and can use that on his other skills, I'm all for that. But I wasn't really blown away with the rest of his game. What are your thoughts on that? Am I being too hard on him, or am I just right?
I know I'm a little bit higher on De'Ron. He's in my second round, for what that's worth. I don't know where you have him. I don't have him as a first round guy.
59, I think.
Right. Yeah. Now. So I have him. I think I have him in the late 40s. And obviously the main reason for that is that I'm buying him, and I know there does need to be advancement made with his footwork and with his lateral movement. But, you know, there were flashes this year where I was extremely intrigued by his, you know, the way that he could step out on the perimeter and provide some value defensively. And, you know, he's not a rim protector. So I don't know what his ideal defensive role is. I don't know where you put him necessarily on defense. And he has to make those, he has to make those advancements kind of as a lateral guy. And this is someone who's 250 pounds, by the way, and about 6'9". So it's not like
65 listed.
Right. Even. Yes, definitely.
Granted, he's probably overlisted, as we kind of alluded to before the show.
Right.
Because I saw him stand next to Baycott, and Baycott looks taller, and he's 6'10". So just saying, he may be pretty overlisted. I have to see him in person before I can confirm that. But he looks and plays smaller than 6'11". I think that's worth noting as well. But add to your point, I mean, you said perfectly, he's not a rim protector. And when you have a big that's not a shooter, not a rim protector, I pretty much instantly get turned off to that guy. And if he doesn't play in pick and roll either, I'm like, oh God, you know, that's red flags everywhere.
There's just nowhere to
finding
play
a fit, fit for him. Yeah, it's like, when I have bigs, like, let's compare him to the guys that we spoke about even even earlier.
Right.
I can find an offensive role for Isaiah Jackson, even if it's one thing. I can throw him lobs, have him cut, score in transition, et cetera. I wouldn't have Dayron do those things.
No. I will and say,
to,
though.
To get his most valuable tool, you have to have the ball in his hands.
Right.
It's like, where do you do that?
I will say, you know, and okay, and anytime you have a prospect that you're like, okay, he needs to be in this situation, like it's normally not going, because, you know, again, there is a 1 out of 30 chance, you know, hypothetically speaking, that he'll go to that team or maybe a little bit higher
situation. Right. Yeah.
So the perfect situation for Dayron, and again, this isn't even talking about defense, let's just talk about him strictly on offense, is that he plays next to an elite kind of scoring big man. To where he can take pressure off him and he can, you know, have big to big action, high low action. That
can also defend in space on the other side.
Right. That can also defend. So we're,
I don't know if that exists.
Those kind of guys. Exactly. So that's why I said, let's mitigate defense completely. Let's just talk about him offensively. I think that's, you know, that's if you want to go strictly offense with Dayron Sharpe, which I'm not sure there's a lot of NBA teams that are like, okay, we're just going to focus on the offensive side.
Yeah, we're going to throw him the ball in the post 42% of his possessions right. And just hope it works out.
A lot of his assists, a lot of what, and not to discount anything off his vision and his processing speed and his touch as a passer and everything that he exhibited at North Carolina, a lot of his assists came off big to big, like almost set action in that North Carolina system where, you know, he, like you said, what was it? 42% of his possessions were in the post.
That's correct. Yeah.
Where he'd post up and then, you know, either Walker Kessler, whatever big man that he was playing with at that time, Garrison Brooks, Armando Bacot, would be strictly diving to the rim, and Dayron would be able to, again, impressive at 6'9" or whatever he is, that he can make that kind of pass. But again, what Alex, you know, what you're alluding to is there's not an offense in the NBA that is going to give him that kind of opportunity, especially when he doesn't have a notable post, you know, move or go-to post move that he can go to that creates offense for himself.
Yeah.
So, and it's like, if you're the defense at the NBA level, it's like, well, now we have, you know, one of his advantages was his size and his frame. He's an absolute tank. He's 6'9" and he's filled out and he looks like a very strong guy. So, you know, he's able to kind of move guys at the college level a little bit easier. If you're an NBA team, I mean, he showed nothing from the perimeter this year and he shot 50% from the free throw line. You're not viewing him as any kind of a shooter or any kind of an offensive threat other than with his passing. So when he becomes one dimensional like that at the NBA level, it's really hard to, at least for me, make a case for him to be productive and to be put into a lineup to where he can succeed.
Yeah. I think you said that perfectly. Finding a lineup for him to succeed in is a very difficult task with the tools he currently has. I think, and this is just my opinion, of course, the path to success for him is developing another tool, something that he can consistently provide in the half court on both ends. That's going to augment his, you know, his processing. Well, it's going to augment the value of his processing speed. Let's say it that way.
Yeah.
For instance, let's say, even though there's no real indicators for that right now, he develops a shot. Let's say he becomes a little 30% three-point shooter. Let's say he gets to the execution Thor has. Okay, that's fine. You have a guy that can be a bit of a stretch big, kind of punish you as a hub that can process the game quickly, occasionally shoot the ball, pick and pop a little bit. But you take away that skill, you know, shooting. Obviously, this may be a bad example because it is one of probably the most valuable skill in the league. But you take away that, it just doesn't provide you with much. So I think he needs something else to rely on so that his secondary skill can be that passing and playmaking. And right now he doesn't have that. So I don't think he's going to be able to lean on his playmaking and processing speed, no matter how good it is right now, just because he can't punish the defense otherwise. And that's a very hard player to fit into your scheme.
Yeah, especially when he's one-dimensional. So, I mean, it comes down to, can he go the direction of, okay, I'm either going to work on my post game, which I don't know if that's the necessary. I don't know if that's the avenue I want him to go down. Or if, you know, if he can develop as a shooter, which probably would be more realistic. I don't know how realistic it is because, again, we saw absolutely nothing from him as a shooter other than 50% from the free throw line and I think point 0.1 attempts per game from behind the arc. So, I mean, I don't even know if he shot a real three this year. But it comes down to
he shot the fact two that 3-pointers.
Right. And he's completely one-dimensional. So I think, you know, with Dayron, he's someone I'd like to see develop, like you said, another skill that he can rely on, another NBA skill that can be useful to a team. Moving on to our last guy in this this big talk, though, is Big Sandro Mamukelashvili from Seton Hall. The senior did 4 years of time for the Pirates. And he took that
leap. That's the NCAA for you right there.
Exactly. And he took that leap this year as a scorer in a higher usage role. He shot a worse percentage from the 3-point line, but on better volume. And as a passer, we obviously just saw a completely different side of him. He's a really interesting prospect. I have him at 46 right now. Sure. And obviously the concerns off the bat are with him defensively. Where do you play him on that side of the ball? Although there are flashes from Mamu that you see when he's locked in. And I know, Alex, you have a tremendous scouting report, so I'll just get my spiel out of the way here early. But when he's locked in on that defensive side of the ball, he does make plays that sell me a little bit more on, you know, maybe he's able to flash rim protection every now and then or at least be serviceable on that end at his highest outcome. But what you're drafting Mamu for is his offensive versatility. The fact that you can use him as a screener in the pick and roll, as a pick and pop guy, as a pick and roll guy, but also as the guy that, at least at the college level, we saw was handling the ball sometimes in those same situations. So extremely interesting. I know he's going to be on teams' radars just because of the fact that he's not a traditional 4-5, but definitely a modern new age kind of player. And I guess just to add in at the very end too, everything that you've heard, Alex, intel wise is great on this guy. I'll let Alex take it away on someone that he did a scouting report. Check that out.
Yeah, it's not out yet. By the way, it probably won't be public, so can't share all of it, but I'll share some of it. Just to summarize, I guess intel on Mamu that I've heard so far is people close to him always seem to like him. They've noted how positive he is off the court, how uplifting of a presence he can be, which is kind of the more frequent thing I heard regarding his personality was he was uplifting in a locker room or in a workout. He's a guy you'll enjoy having on your team and a guy that's going to impact team morale and relationships in a positive way. But he also, you know, seems like he feels a bit slept on. He has a bit of a chip on his shoulder as well, which a lot of guys do. And that can manifest on the court at times with frustration. You know, he can be a bit chippy occasionally and complain to refs a bit more than I would like. But generally, I'm fine with the intel on him. I think he has the mental side needed to find a role in the league. Whether or not that manifests, you know, we'll find out. Just to touch on the defense, get the concern out of the way. What Mamu gives you offensively is, you know, pretty obvious, but defense is where he becomes a hard player to fit into a scheme. He's not a good rim protector due to lacking verticality and standing vertical pop. He'll get one every once in a while, but not somebody I would anchor your defense with, of course. And he's not always quick or fundamentally sound enough to be like a wing defender consistently. So he's kind of stuck in that 4.5 non-rim protector role, which is something like I've seen Lauri Markkanen play in. I think that's kind of a decent, I think he's Tice-sized Lauri Markkanen on defense sometimes, which I take that as you will. So if he plays a four offensively alongside another big, which is his best role on offense, where do you play him on defense? Do you stick him on the opposing four? I don't think he provides you with an advantage at four or five. So, you know, I think he reminds you of what you give up defensively playing somebody like Markkanen at the four in Chicago, but to maybe a higher degree due to Lowry's better tools, if that makes sense. Let's see. I'll talk about his offense real quick because it's my favorite part of him is You know, what's so nice about having a big like Mamu is that you get a guy who can play make as a half court perimeter hub that can also punish you in the pick and pop when you focus on ball handlers, which is something we touched on with Dayron. Is if he had that shooting tool, well, now he could play make, it opens up his game more. Mamu has that. But, you know, that's not all with him. You know, as on top of this, he can pass and handle the ball serviceably enough for kind of a point center, point forward role. That means he'll be able to operate better than most hubs on like power plays, and including having the shooting gravity that he also has, you know, that's even more likely for him to operate really well off power plays. So on a team where Mamu can play alongside a high, you know, PNR gravity guard, you know, maybe a star guard that also has above average shooters and spacing to work with, is probably where Mamu would thrive the greatest offensively. Going into his shooting, while there is still more volatility on his shot with his release and footwork than I would like, he did shoot nearly 34% from deep this year with a much higher degree of difficulty and added volume this year. I mean, his confidence was through the roof as a shooter this year, and you saw it on film. But from the right wing and top of the key, he's very, very strong. He was like 39% in those two spots. So confidence and touch are clearly strong. Touch to a lesser degree, but there's good flashes.
And I think, like, just to add something to that as well, Alex, like, you know, just talking about him, at least as an offensive player, we'll get into more of him on the defensive side of the ball, like avenues to, you kind of touched on where you can play him, you know, where you get the best advantage playing him. But like, man, the shot variance, the degree of difficulty, like you said, the volume that he attempted threes on this year, there's a clear indicator as to why his three-point percentage went down from 43 to 33. Exactly. And it's not even something that I view as a negative, because I'm imagining him, you know, playing in an NBA style offense if he does get that opportunity to be more catch and shoot
conservative,
driven, right? Conservative, getting to his spots and then using that shooting gravity to then segue into being able to attack closeouts and use his playmaking ability, his handle, and his other tools that he has on that offensive side of the ball to be a potentially really successful, like you said, offensive hub. As a 6'10 big guy, I'm sold on him as an offensive player. And I don't know if you have anything more to add to that as well.
I think you put that really well. I think, you know, having a hub that can play point center and space as well and shoot, that's pretty valuable. It's a rare thing to find in the modern game, but still a valuable one. I did want to touch on his interior scoring, because I think that's what hinders him most from being, you know, that true 5-point center, at least offensively, is he doesn't give you somebody that's will give you an advantage as a play finisher or a roll man, except in short roll passing, which I think he's quite good at and has the tools to be good at. But he's also not a vertical threat. He's a slow loader. He doesn't really have the length. I think he'd struggle in a play finisher role. Compared to some of the other guys we have on this list, I think Dayron would be a better play finisher. And I don't think he's strong enough with the ball as he should be to really battle consistently in traffic. Granted, there are very good flashes as well, and he has the audacity to try and dunk on a lot of guys. His ability to put the ball on the floor, though, gives him that ability to go get to his spots off drives and off that hub gravity, and even as a pick and roll ball handler, which he actually got more possessions in this year than as a roll man, which I thought was kind of interesting. So again, when you have a guy that can bring all those skills to your offense as a big, it's pretty obvious that you can find a guy that, you know, you found a guy that's going to put points on the board, get, you know, help teammates out and help run your offense. The only reason he's not a first round guy is because of defense.
I completely agree. Defense, and maybe you can make the age argument as well, but I don't even think the age argument really matters with Mamu as much because of the production that he showed.
Well, he's just about to turn 22. He's a May 23rd, 1999. So he's young for some of the seniors in this class.
Yeah. Um,
I mean, he's younger
and
than
again,
me.
It's not so the production, the, right? Exactly. The production, I think, also just outweighs. Like if you're drafting Mamu, especially where I think, you know, is my projectable draft range for him is kind of that mid second round. I think that's a great way. That's a great place to take a flyer on him. Like if you're drafting him in that range, he's someone that, like, you know, if it hits with him, if the offense and his shooting and his playmaking ability, if it all comes together, he's able to carve out a role in the lineup. Like you get at his peak potentially, you know, by the end of that first contract year, maybe even sooner than that, a really interesting role player and someone that you can deploy in a lot of different situations as an offensive player. And man, if like you stick him next to, you know, some kind of
anchor five,
like I don't know why the first name that's coming to my head is like Miles Turner. If you stick him next to like a Miles,
that's
Turner,
a good combo.
Like it, I mean, because that's what Miles Turner does for Sabonis, especially in Indiana this year.
So I think
Sabonis
that's a perfect comparison.
Right, Sabonis has so many, you know, defensive, I'd say downsides to his game, but they're all really masked when Miles Turner is out there. So if you're able to stick, you know, Mamu next to an anchor five, like we're saying, his value expands because then you're not worried about the negatives that he's producing on that defensive side of the ball, but rather what he can add to your offense and expand to your offense.
That's a great way to put it. And I think if you can get a guy that can be your bench Sabonis, that's a pretty good find. Obviously he's not going to be starter Sabonis, you know, triple doubles and playing games, all that stuff. I don't think he's as good of a rebounder or post score, but he can do some of those things. He has some of those tools that we've seen are valuable in the modern game. And when you compare him to guys like Dayron, he has more tools to bring to you. You know, he may not be good in, as you know, some of the key areas like, you know, rim protection, etc. But there's still value to be found with a guy like Mamu because of how many offensive tools he possesses. I mean, you get a pass, dribble, shoot wing. You like that. You get a pass, dribble, shoot big. That's also very, you know, a little rare, also very valuable.
Yes.
So I think these are the guys you take chances on in the second round because you have clearly multiple tools that can work at the NBA level. And, you know, the right size and motor to play in the league. So I don't see why you don't draft Mamu, especially over guys, you know, some of these other guys. Very much in on him as a second round value pick.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely as a value guy in the second round. I'm pulling the trigger without hesitation on this guy. I think, like we said, there's just the good of what he's, you know, potentially able to provide outweighs the downsides to, you know, which is mainly his defense and kind of where do you play him. But I think there are situations to where he could be masked on that side. And it's like different when we're talking about a guy like Mamu, because with his offensive ability, you want to put him out on the floor. So you're more willing to then compensate for his defense to mask him. I'm not, you know, not to get completely, you know, out on Dayron. And I love Dayron. I love his ability to pass the ball. And I think he's got a bright future ahead of him. But at this point in his career, you're not willing to just, you know, completely let him, you know, have free reign as a passer, interior passer, and then just get, you know, destroyed on the defensive side of the ball. That's not what you're willing to do as an NBA team. You're more willing to, you know, give Mamu minutes with his shooting and dribbling and passing combo, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I think you put it well. Plus, Mamu doesn't have to anchor your defense like Sharp does, because I don't think Sharp plays alongside a center well at all. I think Mamu does offensively. Don't think Sharp does, unless it's, again, so situation dependent, like a Karl Anthony Towns, or I just don't like betting on that.
Yeah.
But with Mamu, you can do it it's a little easier to get his tools providing value, I think is the easiest way I could put it. It's easier to say, coach, we can get this guy on the floor so he can do these things.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's hard to say that for someone like Sharp, the same degree, which is why we're like, okay, Dayron, you should probably develop a couple other tools, because, you know, you're going to need them compared to some of these other guys that are going to go in the second round. So
yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what I was alluding to as well.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And the other thing I want to mention with Mamu is in comparison to Sharp is Mamu can pass too. I mean, he doubled his assist rate and assists on a higher usage, only slightly increasing his turnover rate this year with far less post possessions. I think it was like 23% of his possessions, which is going to change obviously drastically, but he can pass the ball too. He processes the game quickly offensively. He can make reads for teammates. So even if that's to a lesser degree of Sharp, how much is that slightly better processing speed going to differentiate you in the NBA? I think these are questions that teams have got to ask when evaluating these two guys comparatively. I think it's a conversation a lot of people should have regarding tools and getting guys on the court.
Exactly. And just, you know, off the basis of who's playable, who's not. I mean, I think it's definitely a conversation that should be had. And these two guys kind of have some parallels to what their roles will be, but also differences, major differences as to what they provide in their production at this current stage.
Well said.
But that's all we have for these four guys. It's going to be extremely interesting to see if guys like JT Thor and De'Ron Sharp end up staying in the draft. And where bigs like Mamu and Isaiah Jackson end up going in the upcoming draft. We're going to break it down like this year. We did the same thing last year with 2020, where we went position group by position group, or, you know, not position
we'll,
group
we'll
by
break
position.
It up a little more, right. You know, we'll exactly. Go like international bigs, et cetera, right. You know, we'll differentiate a bit.
Right. So just kind of to get more concise on some of these guys. But definitely interested to see where all four of these guys go. And we'll continue to drop these episodes. I hope you guys enjoyed this. If you like the podcast, if you like this episode, leave a nice review. You can follow both of us on Twitter at Ethan Piotta, at AHP Analytics, and at Prospect Pod. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Music, wherever. Alex, thanks as always for coming on, and we look forward to seeing you guys in the coming weeks.
Thank you very much. Have a good one, guys.